You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Ted Bell, who's a New York Times best-selling novelist and former advertising executive. He began his advertising career in the 1970s as a junior copywriter and then worked his way all the way up to president chief creative officer of the Leo Burnett Company in Chicago, which is legendary, where he was credited with developing numerous innovative and award-winning advertising campaigns. In 1982, he joined Young and Robicam in London, and in 1991 became the vice chairman and worldwide creative director. He's won every award the advertising industry offers, including numerous Clios and Cannes Gold Lions, and while at Young and Robicam, the Grand Prix of the Cannes Festival. In 2001, he retired to write full-time. He has 10 consecutive New York Times bestsellers to his credit, probably soon to be 11, including the Alex Hawke series of spy thrillers. The newest in this series is Overkill, and it is out now. So welcome, Ted. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on Spycast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you went from being an exceptionally successful ad exec, worldwide creative directors of one of the most important advertising agencies in the world, to write spy novels. So that's an interesting transition. So what drove you to do that?
Well, first of all, I've been wanting to be a writer since the third grade, and I actually started writing in the third grade. So I was, what, eight? And my great passions then were cowboys, because I had Hopalong and Roy Rogers and the Lone Ranger. These are all of my heroes. And the other thing I was fascinated with, because it was the 50s, was UFOs. So my elementary homeroom teacher used to encourage those of us who wanted to write stories that she would then pin on the bulletin board, and you could take them down and take them home and read them. And then she had a sheet where you could sign in and you'd post a review the next day. So in the third grade, I'm going in early to read my reviews. I wasn't waiting for the Times book reviews. I was waiting for Susie Charlton to say, I like Ted, but I don't like his story. Whatever. And so I combined my two loves of UFOs and cowboys. So I would have cowboys out on a cattle drive getting abducted by tractor beams from UFOs, lifted up out of their saddles and into the UFO. So I had no end of amusement in some 40 years later, seeing that there was going to be a movie coming out in L.A. called Cowboys and Aliens.
Right.
I said, how low will they go if they will steal a story idea from a third grader in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who's 8 years old? And somebody, you know, read the story, I guess. I don't know. Just kidding. But so that's when I started wanting to be a writer. But you're asking about spy novels specifically.
Well, what drove you in that direction? I mean, I think that...
Yeah, I'm living in a small town in the South, in Florida, where excitement was sticking a playing card in the wheel of your bike so it sounds like a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. That was a huge for me, for all of us. And then following the mosquito sprayers around, the DTT... riding in these clouds for hours on our bikes following these guys. And we love the smell of it. Little do we know.
Right.
It's like total poison.
Yeah.
But now I think about all the parents want the kid to have a helmet and, you know, there was no more habit. But we rode around for years in DDT strays and loved, we thought it was fabulous. So the summer I was 13, I was in Little League, but I was terrible and I hated it. And I only went because my dad made me. All I wanted to do was read. Starting at age 6, as soon as I learned how to read, I was in. I was hooked. And so I would go to Little League and just sort of pray for time to be spent alone on the bench, which was a lot of the time.
Right.
Because he didn't like me anymore than I liked the sport. But the summer I was 13, I read my first Bond book. Just, I don't know, out of the blue. And it just... long story short, I read every single Bond book that summer. And it really changed my life. It literally did. Because I didn't know where I was going or what... My family was in the banking business. But I knew then I didn't want to be a banker. And I was flattered to be invited to speak at the Reagan Ranch about 3 years ago when they had the Year of the Spy. So I was the kickoff speaker. And the title of my talk there was... How James Bond Saved My Life. And that's accurate, actually, in a weird way, because who knows what would happen.
Right.
But I just went from palm trees and lazy sunsets to, you know, bullets, bombs, and babes, you know, and martinis and Aston Martins and evil villains and the capitals of Europe and the south of France. It just was like it was like LSD for me.
Right.
So... That's when the seed was planted. And thank God I went into advertising because I got to go to all those places.
Right, no.
And spent a lot of time in those places with a nice little expense account. So for 30 years, right? So that, when we sold Y&R in 2001 or two, whatever, I was ready.
Well, yeah. And I think you've now been writing the character of Alex Hawk for over 15 years.
That's right.
You know, that kind of longevity you only see every so often, whether it's a Jack Ryan or someone like that, or... A James Bond.
Yeah,
I mean, do you see, as you're writing, because I've, because of the job, I've read my share of spy novels.
Sure.
Some try to be uber realistic,
right.
And kind of
Clancy.
In the weeds. Yeah, Clancy, right? Yeah, everything.
Perfect
is
example.
Technology.
It was a 3.99
right.
Rifled shell, seldom used outside of the Huey.
The Chobham ceramic armor and the M1 Abrams. Yeah,
exactly.
And then there are ones like Fleming who write. To have fun.
Exactly.
Do you see Alex Hawk as the Bond of the 21st century?
Is that kind of... In a way, I sort of do. But, you know, when I sat down to create him, I knew that there were going to be Fleming influences. But I didn't want to be... I don't want to have my first critics come out when the book comes out and say, this guy's, like, trying to be James Bond.
Just a derivative,
Not a derivative. I didn't want to be a derivative. So I made him as far away from James Bond's personality as I could be. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the story, but if they're not, they're going to enjoy it. When Fleming went to GoldenEye to write the first book, having had a huge fight with his wife, and I've studied Fleming all my life, huge fight with his wife, and he just couldn't wait to get to their new house in Jamaica. And somebody gave him a golden typewriter. And he's sitting there looking over the sea, and he says, I got to have a name for this guy. So his idea of Bond from the get-go was a bland, and he actually used that word, a bland civil servant. One of the gray men you see in the halls, but they disappear quickly. That was his notion. So he was looking for a boring name, a bland, boring name. Do you know this story? You already know.
They may
okay.
not.
But they
so
may
yeah,
not.
Go ahead.
Okay, so he's got his books on the shelf, and he looks up and he sees this book called Seabirds of the West Caribbean by James Bond. He goes, James Bond sat down in the gloom of the casino at whatever. And so that's where he came up with his name.
Yeah, American Ornithologist.
Yeah, an American Ornithologist.
Yeah.
There you go. And but I didn't want a bland name, so I thought Hawk, you know?
Well, the names, I mean, there's no bland name in any of them.
No.
They're all, you read them, and you're like, there's a twinkle in your eye when you're coming up with these names.
How about this cowboy at Overkill? Do you like his name? You can't say it on the air.
No. No,
but
yes. I mean, I can. We say shit all the time.
Okay.
That's my guess.
I just love having a character named Shit Smith.
Yes.
I mean, I think shit will outlive all of us. He is the baddest of the bad.
Yeah, and you can see that if you try, let me give advice for anyone who goes out and buys any of these books. If you read it without knowing there's a tongue firmly planted in the cheek, then you're going to be like, this is, what is this? This is so over. No. I hadn't met you before today, but I just imagine you writing this just kind of chuckling to yourself.
The whole way through.
Okay. Absolutely.
I mean, when I thought of that name, Mr. Smith, I was tap dancing around the room. I said, I got to just make this the baddest guy on the planet.
So one thing I actually found, I mean, I'm half joking about kind of the tongue in the cheek, but there's actually some obvious preparation that goes into writing these books. You know, there's locations around the world. There's going back to writing your first book. There's kind of understanding how the spy world works. So how do you prepare for writing one of these? It's not just kind of sitting down and writing off the top of your head. There's obvious preparation that goes into this.
Well, a couple of things. When I decided that I could not, at the time when I was starting, everybody, all my competitors or everybody was writing about, you know, Al-Qaeda and variations thereof. And they're all doing it. And I can't do it. First of all, I don't like sand. I don't like deserts and camels.
You don't want to have to go like to Ferraris, your research in Sana'a, like Yemen. You'd rather go to the...
And nude beaches in the southern. That's just me. I just call me crazy. And I can never pronounce all the names. And this is not a racist comment. I just, you know, the names are like 15 syllables long. And I just couldn't see myself writing those names. So I said, you know what? Putin. And because I was fascinated with the guy. And so I started by just reading biographies and just getting inside his head. Because I knew if I was going to make him a real character, I wanted to feel comfortable saying things and acting like he might under certain circumstances or just be in his head. Mm-hmm. And then when that was done, then I went to Russia because I'd never been. And I just had to see Moscow and St. Petersburg and all these places. You know, not so much for like, oh, there's a restaurant there, but just the feeling of it,
right?
And the street, and the mood of the place, and so I did. And as a precursor to that story, I'll just tell one other little aside. Obviously, you meet people in the community, you know, when you do this kind of stuff, and so I had some good friends that were helping me, and one of them was a professor at Cambridge University. And he was an advisor to me on technical things or political things, geopolitical things, from like the second or third book. So he was a really good friend of mine. And so lo and behold, sixth book, something like that, I was doing a book signing at Barnes & Noble on a rainy night. And there he is, my friend, who was in town and heard about it and showed up. And he had another guy with him. You don't like this story.
I know the story, but go ahead.
You already know.
I do my research. I know where you're going. It's a great story.
I didn't know that story was built. But, and I said, great, nice to meet you. I hope you guys, and I'll talk to you after the show or something. So I did it and then started talking. And then he said, well, Richard and I are going to go get a bite at Swifty's. You want to have dinner with us? He'd love to talk to you some more. I said, yeah, sure, I'd love it. So we go to dinner, have a few cocktails. And the whole time he's asking me about, where did you have this idea of Putin? How did you... That you think the Baltics or you think the is going to be where he's going to go next or whatever, and I said I just make it up. And he said, yeah, that's good. And then at the end of the dinner, he says to my friend, wouldn't it be fun to have Ted at Cambridge at the political sciences with us, because he doesn't think the way we do, you know? It'd be fun. And the guy turns out to be Sir Richard Dearlove, who was just recently getting ready to retire, I think, at that point, but was still then chief of MI6 and was going to leave and go be master of Pembroke College, Cambridge. So I went. And I spent a year, 2011, 2012, and it was spy heaven. Because everybody's a spy there.
Right.
Everybody.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting concept about bringing in fiction writers, because they certainly think a very different way.
Yeah, we do.
And sometimes people are so caught and kind of the formal regimented way of thinking about threats and thinking about possibilities that they're just not willing to look outside
the
box.
What are the preconditions? No. I just go right to the cut to the chase.
And what during that year, what was your day-to-day? Like, what were you doing?
Well, I was attending lectures, and I was going up to the Naval College in London to hear, you know, all the Royal Navy guys in one room talking about what's happening in the China, mm-hmm. South China Sea, what are we going to do about it? I was attending lectures and one of the things I had agreed to do is I would write a book with Cambridge as the setting and portray the college. And mm-hmm. that was easy to do. Mm-hmm. Oldest university in the world, I think. And it was like wandering around in Harry Potter land. You know? I mean, those rooms that go on for a mile with the tables, with right. the candles, and the guy. And that's accurate.
Yeah.
You know, because every Friday night there's a master's dinner, and you're sitting up at a table on a dais, and you're just staring out of a sea of kids are getting so hammered, by the way, that they're like falling out of their chairs by the end of the night. And all the masters always said, Ted, I want you to sit next to me at dinner tonight, of different colleges. It's a different college area. And so I was flattered. So I said to my friend, that's really nice. You know, that every time the masters at the cocktail party at the master's study say, Ted, I want you. He said, No. Don't flatter yourself. I said, well, they do. He said, yeah. You know why? Because all these guys want to be published authors. Yeah. They want to say, can you get the name of your agent? Yeah. No, I'd say that's true. He was sort of kidding. But it was fun. But I just will tell you one moment. I was in a meeting that Sir Richard was speaking in. And what do we call it? Not house rules, but there's a rule where it's this code of silence. Something house rules. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Chatham House rules?
Chatham House rules. And it was a Chatham House rule meeting. And about halfway through the thing, it's a knock on the door, and he opens the door, and there's this guy standing there with these big, like, pizza-sized boxes, about six of them. And he brings them in and puts them on the table. There's like 12 of us in the room. And so Richard opens the first box, and it's a gold platter, like about twice as big as a basketball. I mean, it's like this big around. And they had been taken from Libya from after, what's his name?
Gaddafi's
palace. After they took him out, and they sent him to Zurich. Now, I don't know what he did with him. I'm sure he sent him back to somebody. But he's passing him around the table. And I'm sitting there, just like a day after the guy is executed. I said, I'm looking at the guy's plates.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a little moment of Cambridge history for you.
No, what's interesting to me, many times talking to authors, because everyone kind of treats their craft in a different way. Some people write and then kind of change things as they go along, yeah. kind of more stream of what direction should I go in.
Oh, I do that.
Others sit down before they write a single word and map everything
absolutely
out
right.
in every direction. Is that your process? Do you know what the book is going to look like from a skeletal sense?
No idea. I know who the bad guy is. I know who the girlfriend is. And I sure as hell know who the hero is.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a quick story. I don't know how our time is. But so when I first was working on Hawk, which is the first Alex Hawk book, I was a neighbor of and a good friend of, because I'd known him in advertising, James Patterson. And he and I played golf a couple times. I mean, we're pals. Mm-hmm. And he knew I was writing this book. And he said, well, you know what? Just when you got the manuscript, let me take a look at it. So I said, I'd love it. And he said, I'll get it to some people. Don't worry. I said, great. So phone rings and it's Jim. He says, can you come over to my house? It was like 6 o'clock. Can you come over to my house for a little while? I'm going to talk to you. And I said, sure. So I go over there, and he's sitting by his pool or whatever. We're talking. He says, let me ask you a question. Why do you, in your, I liked your manuscript, but I have a serious issue here. Why do you go down all these different roads? I said, I like going down roads. Because I don't know where I'm going to end up.
Yeah.
I like to sit down in the morning and not know where I'm going. He says, no, listen, you know, outline, which is how he does it.
Right. When he writes a book every month or whatever.
Well, every day.
Yeah.
A book a day. So I said, Jim, that's just not me, man. I don't want to do that. So I go out and I said, I just told the world's most successful novelist that he's wrong about how much you write my book. But I mean,
you still have to do some pretty significant preparation.
Because
when I was reading Overkill, I realized that there was in-depth knowledge of geography, mm-hmm. like random geography, like mountains in Switzerland, and in-depth knowledge.
The Swiss military.
Yeah, Swiss military, and in-depth knowledge of stuff like the Russian political oligarchy and how the Swiss banking systems and everything, like,
absolutely.
You have to do that ahead of time, I would suspect, or do you stop and say, oh crap, I need to do some research on this. I've written my way to a point in which I need to stop and make sure I know what the hell I'm talking about.
I think I have read so much in my life that I retain. I certainly do some of that, but a lot of it is, I read a book in, I don't know, when it came out 15 years ago called La Concours Suisse de la Palais. And it was by a famous author that, I can't remember his name right in a second. But it was all about the Swiss military and jet fighters being stored inside the Alps. I said, oh, love this. Mm-hmm. So
It's basically a real life Bond lair.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the Bond lair that I created, called Falcon's Lair, I made up. But I based it on Eagle's Nest, Hitler's, in the Bavarian Alps. And, the genesis of Overkill. I thought Goldfinger was far and away my favorite. I mean, I love From Russia with Love, like her, but Goldfinger, and the reason I liked it was he Fleming created such an impossible task for the villain. He's going to rob Fort Knox? I mean, in that era, Fort Knox was considered, your money's as safe there as it is at Fort Knox. I mean,
it was considered Fort Knox.
It was considered Fort Knox. So when I see the trailer, and I see that, wait, this guy is going to rob Fort Knox? Good luck with that, pal. Good luck with that. And of course he did. I mean, he put everybody to sleep. But remember, he had the gas.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, when I was getting ready to write the new one, I said, I would love to top him, you know, and come up with some place really hard to get the gold out of. That'd be Switzerland.
Yeah.
Because they got a million man army. They've got a massive air force. You know, they've prevented invasion for 200 years. But in the book, my villain, who we know is, I don't know if I should reveal that or not, but it's...
I mean, if they've read the last one, they know.
Yeah, Putin is out of power, and he's been chased out of the Kremlin by the oligarchs. And he wants to... And the oligarchs have been stealing all his gold. So he says, I'm going to go in there, and I'm not only going to get my own gold back, I'm going to take a little extra. And so he's planning and mounts an invasion of Switzerland. And from a cinematic perspective, because I hope and I know that the movie guys love Overkill as a title, and they love the plot. They haven't read it, some of them. But be great as a second one.
Because there's going to be a first one. We're trying to jump the gun a little bit.
Yeah, there's going to be a first. And you know when I'm going to believe that? When I'm sitting in the theater with the popcorn with Victoria. Honey, look. It says, based on the novel of Ted. That's me. They actually did.
Theoretically, the book before Overkill has been optioned. Well, not theoretically.
All the books have been optioned by Paramount.
Oh, okay. So that's all lots of potential
all
movies
of them,
here.
All of them. And we have a script, which I haven't read yet, but that's okay.
Is the script based on the last book?
No, it's based on Patriot.
Okay.
But it's called Hawk because we want the first one to have the title of the character. So I forgot where I was going with that story.
Just about the character that can't... The evil villain that has the impossible task.
Right.
Which, in this case...
And the other... Oh, I know. The cinematic quality. So I spent a lot... I lived in Switzerland for a while. I mean, I've spent a lot of time there in Zurich and Lucerne, all those places. And it's such a picture postcard. It's like a fairy tale. Those little villages with the geraniums in the windows and the... It's just, and I said, the idea of armed conflict, especially modern armed conflict, happening in that country is just too wild to conceive of. You know, dogfights over, Gutenbaden, Switzerland, with cows in the field. Yeah. You know, and every bridge and every tunnel is wired. Every one of them. And you show up at a bridge with a tank, you're going in the ravine. I mean, really an impossible task for him to successfully invade. But he comes up with an ingenious way of getting that army in there. It was the locomotive convention in the Zurich rail yard. So he just goes blasting through Europe all night, running barricades and blasting his way across. So anyway, it's I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, you write in a way where you can easily imagine what's happening. I mean, sometimes you're reading a book and you've got to struggle to kind of picture
what's
it.
What's this about?
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit SixthSense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Is it important to have a really good baddie? I mean, I know that sounds kind of trite as a question, but is there a paucity of good bad guys in a lot of the spy novels that have been written since Bond? I mean, Fleming always had the great bad guy, right?
Bigger than life
villain. And to a degree, you're right that a lot of your contemporaries, when you started writing this, were about Al-Qaeda and others, and as dangerous as they are, there's not a lot of bigger-than-life bad guys.
That's right.
Is it important for you to kind of come back to that? I mean, Putin is perfect for
this. He's perfect. Yeah. And now a lot of these guys have moved to Putin.
Yeah.
You know, like Dan Silva's new book is about Putin. But, which is fine. That's great. I mean, it's not, I don't own him.
Well, but you predated them significantly. I mean, it's been, what, 10 years?
10 years.
Yeah.
Czar was the one. TSAR was, it was 2008. But I think, you know, when I was in the days of thinking about how I was going to do this, I realized, okay, I've got my hero now. You know, he looks like Errol Flynn, he talks like William Powell, and he's a Royal Navy fighter pilot, shot down 3 times, blah, 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 blah. So I got him. Now I need a bad guy and a girlfriend. That's what I do every single time. I say, all right, who's the bad guy? Because I can't always go with Putin.
No.
And I'm definitely not going to do Putin in the next book. But and I need a new girlfriend.
Or sometimes a recycled one.
Or a recycled girlfriend. Yeah. But I remember in the first one, Hawk, I wanted him to have a girlfriend that every woman would like, oh, she's wonderful, she's great, she's perfect for him. So I created this Victoria Sweet, and she was a child psychiatrist from Washington who worked with, you know, children who had learning disabilities. And she's also a kind of a Beatrix Potter children's illustrator and writer of fairy tales, you know, Peter Rabbit kind of things. Just a wonderful woman. Mm-hmm. And he loved her. So then when the next book's coming, I was at Simon & Schuster then with my editor, Emily. And she said, so Ted, in this new book, what are we going to do about Victoria? Not you. What are you going to do about Victoria? I said, I don't know, but I have an idea. And she said, okay, what is it? I said, well, what if he marries her? And she said, are you out of your mind? He can never get married. Ever. Ever, ever, ever.
Bond got married.
I know. Yeah. Well, and so did Hawk. But
yeah.
And he's a bachelor. That's part of his charm. He's a bachelor. Just keep him as a bachelor. And I said, well, I can't have him dump her because then he's a jerk. He's the bad guy. And I can't have her dump him because then he looks like, you know, whatever. So I said, so Emily, what if he marries her but she doesn't quite survive the wedding ceremony? She said, she dies in the church? No, she actually dies on the steps of the church after the ceremony when they're throwing the rose petals and the U.S. Navy guys are there with the cross swords. Mm-hmm. She takes one to the heart from a sniper in a tree who's trying to make life painful for Alex Hawk. And so there you go. She said, Ted, that is horrible. That is really, really horrible. I said, yes, it is. But is it good horrible or bad horrible?
Right.
She said, it's great horrible. Do it.
Great horrible. That
great
should be
horrible.
Like,
yeah, oxymoron.
Well, that should be on the front of the book. Great horrible.
Great horrible.
Yeah. So let me ask you one last thing about something that you were involved with, the Defense Orientation Conference Association, mm-hmm. something you've gone on mm-hmm. to actually do more with. Can you talk a little bit about DOCA? Because I think our listeners might be interested in that program.
Yeah, it's great. It's a standing, not a committee, but a group of people from all different walks of life, you know, from finance or the arts, like a writer. And you have to be sponsored. And I was sponsored by a friend of mine, Lieutenant White, who was Coast Guard, and who was a big fan of the books, and had read them when he was off on assignment or whatever. And
he sponsored me, and I got in. So it's basically people who support the military and with a passion. And it's a way for us on an annual and sometimes more frequently basis to sort of catch up with what's going on. And my first trip was, we had a C-130 Hercules at our, 13 of us, C-130 Hercules at our disposal for a week.
That's not exactly first class travel.
No, it's not first class. No, it's not. The seat is a sling.
Yeah.
In the middle of a basketball stadium. Yeah. I mean, it's like insane. But our first stop was MacDill Air Force Base, where CENTCOM, where we were going to get to meet Petraeus. Now, it turned out he couldn't make it that day, but we had his number two guy. And then we went to Fort Bragg, and we went to Little River. We spent 2 days at Fort Bragg, where we had a reenactment of in a mock village out in the middle of that vast pine forest around Fort Bragg. And they had Al-Qaeda guys on horseback coming in like cowboys and Indians, kind of, and running around and around. And we were ordered to get into this building and go up to the roof, where we had Rangers up there with, and it's like I'm in the middle of a war. Right. It's like so real. And then they kept saying, "Sir, they're getting closer. You got to get those guys out of there." And so then these Hueys come in, land on the roof. We run, we jump inside, we take off, and the guys are at the 50 cals going. It was awesome. And we went to Paris Island and spent time being yelled at, and they just yelled at us the whole time we were there. And we went everywhere, and it's fabulous. And so then you hopefully will go back to your real life and talk about what a good experience you had. And I can tell you, I spent 4 days, not through DOCA, but on my own, as a guest of Admiral White on the USS George Washington aircraft carrier for night quals, landings. The people on that ship, the Navy personnel, the nicest people I've ever met in my whole life. Unbelievable.
Does that help you research-wise? You certainly have relationships on the British side, as you just talked about earlier. Does that help your writing? If you've got a question, you can go to an expert.
Absolutely, absolutely. But not only that, it makes me feel good about the military, and that's what they want us to do. And they're succeeding, because it's easy to feel good about our military. They're the most amazing men and women on the planet. And then hopefully tell people. I think the reason I got in is because they knew I'm pro-military, and I'm going to talk about that military in a very positive way in my books, and I do.
Well, you've decided to focus on a British secret agent and then a British inspector, and then that... Was that a conscious decision with kind of the Fleming-esque thing to it, or why not a CIA versus an MI6?
I think it's just because I've lived in England a few times and I love it. I think it's just I wanted to be there in my head when I'm writing the book.
You know, my worry, writing dialogue, I would just be like, "Hello, Governor."
Hello, Governor.
I would because you do have vernacular of exactly right. You do have vernacular of regions and other things that people speak in.
Yeah.
And I know you spend a lot of time there. I've spent some time there, but I would be terrified that it would almost be a kind of caricature.
I think all the years I spent reading Dickens and P.G. Woodhouse, all that's coming out, especially with Ambrose Congreve, Chief Inspector. I just know exactly how this guy would talk and act, and plus the time at Cambridge, knowing professors and stuff like that. So, I'm a sponge.
Are there any real-life people that you've based characters on?
All
that
the time.
Yeah.
Not Chit Smith. I don't know him.
But not by name, at least.
But, I do. I think there's a lot of people I've known my whole in to some degree in every sort of character. I've never really known anybody like Alex Hawk, but because he's an idealized version of what the British spy would be.
So there are now 11 full-length books and then several novellas?
I think it's 10.
So this is the 10th?
Yeah, I think Overkill is number 10. And then I have the two young adult historical novels, Time Pirate and Nick of Time, with different publisher, St. Martin's. But now 12 all together. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to keep writing these things until I go blind. It's just life. It's like air. Right. It's air to me. It's really fun.
Well, the book Overkill is out now. It will more than likely join all the others as a raging success. I don't know if they're going to make 10 movies or 12 or 15 movies 30. Out of this. 30. But, I, you know, at least one probably.
At least one, please, God.
At least one probably will be made at some point. And so we're looking forward to that. Because I think, I say this all the time, that there is a happy medium between trying to be uber serious like some spy fiction is, which you actually run the risk of making mistakes and them counting.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Because if you're trying to portray a narrative that's supposed to be real,
yeah,
and you're not.
And you have a safety on a Glock.
Yeah, that's a problem.
You
right?
have a safety on a Glock, yeah. You're going to hear from people.
That's
about
a problem. But if, you know, in this case, I get asked all the time, what do you think about spy fiction? I'm like, well, if they're not taking themselves too seriously, I love it.
Yeah.
But if they are and they screw up, then I'm the worst person to be around.
I will never write a realistic spy novel based on that comment.
Yeah, it's like a doctor in like a ER show or whatever. Right, but if you're having fun with it, I love it. And so I've read Overkill, but I certainly went back and checked out some of the other ones. And the characters are a lot of fun. And so are the books and the stories. I just imagine you just like chuckling to yourself the entire time you're writing these. So, Ted, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Ted Bell is an author of now 10 consecutive New York Times bestsellers. The newest is Overkill. We appreciate you taking the time.
I really enjoyed it, and I'm being totally honest about that. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it.